Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
And this is the Shame-Free Zone. My name is Veronica Monet, and it is Monday, July 19th. What a very intriguing topic tonight. Pink Japan. I just put the question out on Facebook. What do you think a pink Japan is? It could be a drink, huh? I don't know. Maybe it's a special vacation package. I'm not sure, but I do know that we're going to find out. My guest tonight is Midori. Midori is a globe-trotting sexuality educator and writer. She's best known for her humanistic, funny, and warm classes that help people spice up their sex lives, encourage self-discovery, and personal growth. She's originally from Japan, but she's now based in San Francisco. She is a world traveler, passionate about bedroom skills, and you can find out more about her at planetmidori.com. If you happen to be one of my Facebook friends, pop on over to my page. I will be posting her website in about 30 seconds. Midori, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Thanks for having me.
Ah, it's my pleasure and my honor. You're a very busy woman, and so I'm just grateful we were able to get you on the show tonight.
Me too. Yeah, it took a little bit of forward planning, but we made it happen.
It absolutely did. Before we get into what a pink Japan is, would you do you want to tell us where you've been? Because I know you've always been off doing exciting things.
Oh, yeah. I just landed a couple hours ago from Denver, where I was teaching at a couple different places. I was teaching at Smitten Kitten, which is this wonderful boutique, and also teaching at Thunder in the Mountains, which is a leather event. So I was doing a double fold, a bunch of classes there. I just came back from that, and
some of our listeners might not know what a double fold is.
Oh, just meaning doing two different types of events. On one side, I was appearing at a store that was a general sexuality and sex positive boutique. So you know, I've got that, and then on another aspect at during the same period, I'm also presenting to other interest groups, and in this case, it was folks who are interested in kinky stuff.
Oh, okay.
So, meaning that, you know, I'm in...
A double presentation. You know,
right,
I thought it was going to
be
some special BDSM technique or a rope trick or something.
No, just meaning that I was presenting to two different demographics and interest groups. I teach on so many different things that when I visit a town or a city, I could end up presenting to, say, like the undergraduate sexuality course, and then I'll teach to a gay men's sexual health group, and then I could end up teaching to a swingers group, and then the next day I might be teaching to a kinky group, and then another day, and that evening I might be teaching a fellatio class. Yeah, so...
Just your well-rounded, would you call yourself a sex educator or a sexologist?
Oh, I'm a sexuality educator, yeah.
Ah, fabulous. Now, what got you started in this?
Let's see. Actually, in the early 90s, I was doing grassroots safer sex education. I also volunteered through the San Francisco Sex Information, which you're familiar with. And
I am.
Yeah, and fell into the lovely, lovely cradle of sex positivity and activism in San Francisco, and, you know, started with volunteer work, really. And I never knew I actually had a talent for public speaking. I had no idea. It was not something that I got to develop in college or anything like that. And turns out I'm pretty good at talking about this stuff and public presentation in general. So, yeah.
It could be a lot of fun, huh?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm an idealist, and, you know, not only is the glass half full, but the glass has the potential to be, you know, overflowing with more to come kind of gal. So, yeah, you know, I took my eternal optimism and idealism and decided that I was going to do something which I was passionate about, which was, well, you know, get people to shed their shame and be happy with who they are. And be, you know, and love better. Yeah.
Right. That's a very worthwhile gift. And, you know, I'll be so bold to say I think you're doing your part to create world peace.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, you know.
The happier people are with sex, I think the less violent and angry and destructive they are.
Agreed. Completely agreed.
So tell us about Planet Midori. You just have the most intriguing titles and topics here. We've got Pink Japan and Planet Midori, but what is Planet Midori about?
Oh, planetmidori.com. I have so many facets and so many things I'm interested in, from my education work, my volunteer work, to my artwork, as well as the books and articles that I write. The planetmidori.com is that one page that covers all my various different activities. And if you go there, you know, you'll find everything from my link to Facebook, link to Twitter, link to my blog, as well as my art projects and my classes. So I just stuck it all there. Everything about me is there. Yeah. And from there, people can go find out my classes or whatever, because I've got various little satellite sites covering specific aspects of me, but it all comes under Planet Midori.
Well, and Midori, so it's Planet Midori and then Midori travels the planet as well.
Do you
get out on international venues very often?
I do, actually. I am a hopeless travel junkie, and I think I ended up creating this career path, which is absolutely insane. It's a good thing. I love what I do, and I also love traveling. But, yes, international, I'm actually going to be going back to Japan again this fall. I'm actually going to be teaching and performing there. And sexuality classes there are something entirely new. So I've got that coming up. I'm also in October going to be teaching in Copenhagen, Denmark, and London. So those are some of the international things. Oh, and let's not forget our neighbors to the north. Next week I'm going to be teaching in Toronto. I'm actually doing a weekend intensive with Laura Antoniou about forming mindful relationship around power exchange. So we're doing a weekend intensive on that. And I'm also teaching a hands-on rope bondage class at Come As You Are. So I'm going to Toronto and Ottawa.
Yeah, you don't consider yourself a pro-dom or a dominatrix, but you do teach BDSM techniques. Can you clarify that for us?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Oh, okay. Well,
I'm not a professional dominant, no.
Right, but you do teach workshops about some aspects of BDSM, or?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
And
I think my listeners might like some clarification about, I think usually when somebody's teaching that class, sometimes there's an assumption about their identity. So it's nice to clear that up, and it's actually a lot more blurring in the boundaries than I think was originally thought, even to the point to where people who are into BDSM don't necessarily wear the kind of clothing that some people think is associated with that. So I thought maybe you could educate us a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess maybe
You've got to keep in mind my listeners here are not necessarily professional sex workers, and they're not necessarily going to sex classes all the time. So.
Oh, okay, right. You know,
have to give them some element. You know, some
yeah, kink class. Yeah, kink classes. I actually don't even call it BDSM. I mean, if you want to call it that, I'm all right with that. You know, call it whatever you want to, but it's just all sorts of different sex styles. I don't actually really distinguish it a whole lot as BDSM. I might think of it as, you know, kinky stuff classes.
Okay.
But, yeah, I think there's probably some misconception out there about what people might call BDSM. It's just playing cops and robbers, you know, the cops and robbers and having some fun with sex. The great part about being a grown-up is you can play childhood games of cops and robbers with full adult sexual privilege.
See, I think that's an excellent explanation. That really demystifies that. It takes a lot of probably the fear that some people have about whatever they think they've seen on TV shows.
Oh, you know, Lord, you can't believe what you see on TV. And yeah, I find it really interesting. You know, a person will look at a TV show, and there'll be like some guns being waved around, high-speed chases in L.A., which is, you know, that's the part you can't believe, right?
Right.
High-speed chases through L.A., and there'll be, you know, tons of people with guns and unbelievably rich people, and then there'll be some kinky sex scene. And you'll watch that in one TV show, and no one's going to believe the high-speed chase in L.A., and nobody's going to believe that every American has guns. Yeah, at least not Americans. And people are going to look at the filthy rich people portrayed in the movie as being movie characters, and they're all, you know, thinking, oh, this is, you know, fantastic fiction. But then they look at the kinky sex part and think, oh, that's real. I mean, that's just about as representational. Yeah, okay, there are some really filthy rich people in L.A., and once in a while you might be able to drive fast in L.A., and some people in the United States have guns, and some people in the U.S. have, you know, wild sex and fancy outfits. But the reality is, you know, somebody's got fuzzy handcuffs in their bedside table. They've got a blindfold. And maybe somebody has, you know, a hunting gun occasionally that they go out with their dad to, you know, go, you know, with a deer hunting license. You know, it's really interesting that when it comes to suspension of disbelief and understanding what's fact and fiction, we can make sane decisions and understand what's fiction in everything but sex.
It does, yeah, I know when I'm speaking to audiences, I'm often trying to relate it to food or marriage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those
are yeah, you know, it's... Yeah, if you're watching, I love that show, the guy that eats all the bizarre foods.
Right.
You know, travels the world. I think it's great. I love that show, you know, the bugs, the weird food. But come on, most of us don't eat like that. Yeah.
No.
So I find that most people have a wide range of interest in different kinds of sex, and it just might be something little, like, you know, fuzzy handcuffs, or might be a little blindfold, or might be a little role-playing, or might be, you know, husband and wife pair, you know, they'll pretend like they don't know each other and pick each other up at a bar and then go to a hotel room and play stranger sex.
Absolutely. Yeah, and,
yeah.
And really, you know, when we say the word kinky even, it's not...
what is it, you know?
Now, what does that mean? I mean, for some people, they'll feel like, oh, does that mean I'm perverted, right? And I think,
you know, it's like spicy food, right? Do you like spicy food?
Of course.
I love spicy food, right? But there's always somebody that likes food spicier than you, and there's always somebody that likes food that's not spicy as you like it. And when we sit around the table, you know, get a bunch of friends, like 10 friends going out to a dinner, you know, somebody's going to be like, they can't even look at black pepper. And then somebody else is like drinking straight from the Tabasco.
Yeah, true. With a water chaser if you're lucky. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Same deal. So, you know, what's kinky, right? As far as I'm concerned, kinky is that thing that makes you blush, and it's that particular sex style of yours that you might only tell your best friend.
Hmm.
And because that is, you know, it's constantly changing. I mean, it wasn't long ago when, oh no, you know, oral sex was considered taboo, and anal sex taboo. Yeah, you know, the idea of what's taboo changes and shifts. And when it all comes down to it, it's about, you know, consent, speaking your mind, asking for what you want, saying what you don't want, and respecting one another and seeking pleasure.
And really, what you just said there are skill sets that a lot of people don't actually possess. They're not able to talk about sex, even with somebody they've been having sex with for a long time.
Exactly. And, my classes often enable people to talk about that because I'll give them terminology. They can talk about what I said, or what I showed instead of what, instead of, you know, they can talk about sex in terms of a third party reference. So it'll be me. You know, oh, remember what Midori said about anal sex. What do you think about that? Instead of saying, honey, I'd like to try anal sex.
A great icebreaker for a conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a very good reason. So,
And my classes actually end up being fabulous date nights for people because I make sure they're fun. You know, the folks that come to my classes, they're ordinary day folks. They got kids, they got work, they got lives, they've got partners, or maybe they're back on the dating market. And they'll show up with their sweetie, and I make sure that it's fun. Oh, like when I'm doing my oral sex class, whether it's him, oral sex on him, Joy Six Secrets, or the oral sex on her, it's actually hand and mouth, how to eat a peach. I always love it when the partners show up. Excuse me, allergies. But I love it when the partners show up with.
Right.
And sometimes, okay, so if I'm doing the Joy Six Secrets class, the guys will be like, well, why should I come? You know, why, I'm the guy, why am I coming? And I'll tell the dudes, now think about it. You could hold the zucchini. You could be the designated zucchini holder. And if I'm showing a technique that you like, make sure you give a little elbow nudge to your sweetie. Right? And, you know, for the how to eat a peach class, I'll have guys saying, oh, I don't need to take that class. I get that.
Oh, yeah.
I don't need to take, yeah, the guys, you know, so I don't need to take that class. And then the lady, you know, standing next to him will be kind of rolling her eyes a little bit. And then the way that I explain it, because guys, a lot of guys are kind of shy about sexuality workshops, and I understand that. If they've never been, you know, they're imagining all sorts of, you know, eyes wide shut kind of thing. I don't know what they're imagining. If that's what they're imagining, I'm afraid I'm going to happily disappoint them. Because they do get to do hands-on practice, mind you, but their hands-on practice is on plums and lollipops.
Ah, yes.
Yes, yes. I make sure that they come away learning how to do tongue lift exercises. But, you know, so the guys are saying, why should I come to this class? And why should I bring my lady with me? And I explain it, well, if I'm doing something that your lady likes, your lady can tell you. And sex is like cooking or a game of tennis. You can be fabulous and excellent, but you can always improve your game.
And do you think that men have some kind of a need to feel like they're experts in when it comes to sex? I've certainly have encountered a lot of guys who are like, sex educator, I mean, well, I certainly don't ever need any help. It's just kind of an attitude like they know it all.
I think it's culturally specific because I don't hear that a whole lot when I'm in places like Denmark.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with it in America then?
Well, what I just said in terms of, hey, you know, you can always improve your game. And here's the thing, whether you're a guy or a gal, don't you want to be the best lover that your partner has ever had? You know, you're that lover, that shag, that roll in the hay, the roll in the hay for a lifetime that they're going to be thinking of when they're old and on their deathbed.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. I mean, we want to be that. We want to be just that lover that rocks the world. And, yeah, so why not? And it's all these hobby classes, right, or sailing or football or making things. And if people take classes.
Or cheat sheets for your video games.
Yeah. You know, you're going to get, you want to get better with, you know, improve your game. Yeah, hell yeah, you're going to take a class. You're going to take classes, and you're going to take classes not just from one of the best presenters, but you're going to take classes from all the different kinds of sexuality educator. Because, say, what I have to teach on one subject, another instructor on the very same subject will have yet another insight.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, okay, enough of the suspense. What is Pink Japan?
Oh, Pink Japan is my fabulous travel talk slideshow about the contemporary sex culture in Japan. It's about the sexual underground in Japan, and I have this fantastic two-hour slideshow and talk. Think of it like, imagine you're watching a Travel Channel, and if they had an after-hours R-rated travel show, but I am a nerdy egghead, so I also throw in a lot of comparative culture, comparative sexuality, talk about interesting aspects about Japanese sex trends and sexual cultures, and comparing it to ours. So I'll start off by talking about the love hotels. And, of course, doing this presentation, of course, it means that I have to constantly go back to Japan and make sure to continue to research the material because trends and languages are constantly changing.
What a difficult life you have.
Yeah, so there I am. You know, if I have to go to a strip joint or a sex club or a swingers club, you know, every entry fee and every glass of beer that I have is a write-off. Because,
it's,
you know,
all business expense.
I couldn't go to a strip show and not pay the bar fee. Of course not.
Of course
not.
How
else am I going to get to talk to the strippers?
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's research.
Absolutely.
Well, we had a couple comments here, just a couple of people. Venture to guess. I asked, what is a Pink Japan? Aspasia Bonacera says, a Japan during Hello Kitty's Iron-Fisted Reign? Question mark. And then John Reynolds says, it sounds tasty. So they're having
a
bit of fun with the term.
Good. The word pink, or actually pinku in Japan, is a kind of a code word. It's code word for things sexy. You know how we used to talk about adult movies as blue movies?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah, same deal. So the word pink is double entendre for things erotic. Maybe not necessarily directly, you know, humpy sexual, but things erotic. To include the sex industry, to include the sexual minorities, to include the various sex cultures. Yeah.
So it's not a reference to, you know, because the porn term is that if you show a little bit of pussy, then that's showing pink.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought Pink Japan was about pussy.
No, it's more about anything erotic.
Anything erotic.
Yeah, pinku. Yeah, and that's the title that I use for my class, my presentation, to get the discussion rolling.
Huh.
And the sexual underground in Japan is vibrant and has been for centuries, actually. And what I find interesting is that in the U.S., there's such a mystique and a lot of misinformation about what sexuality in Japan is like. There's rampant misinformation and fantasies that, you know, if they were leftist fantasy, that's great, but some people think it's fact. So the presentation is there to shed light on it. And I also write regularly on it. I write two different biweekly columns, and actually if folks go to Planet and Dory, they'll find the link to my regular columns. And I've written about the gay lesbian neighborhood in Tokyo. I've written about the love hotels. I wrote about the Japan fetish ball. I'm hoping to do some interviews with the Lesbian Comic Artists Association in Japan that I've made some inroads to. So they're lesbians that write, yes, they're lesbians in Japan that write erotic, draw erotic comics.
Wow. Yeah. So there is a, like you say, usually when you think of Japan, you think about little girls in short mini skirts turning tricks with older businessmen. And what do they call that, anime?
Anime, yeah. And cosplay or cosplay, yeah.
Yeah, explain those, if you will, for people who've never heard of it.
Sure. Cosplay or costume play. There's a huge culture, youth culture, around dressing up in fantastic outfits, often inspired by comic book characters, and hanging out. Socializing, and a whole culture around costume role play. Now, the overarching group of people that do that isn't necessarily sexual about it, but like everything, there is also a subculture within a subculture that is into sexualizing that. And, you know, much in the way that if you go to a Star Trek convention, there's going to be the after party.
That's
right. Sexual. Yeah, same sort of deal. So there's the non-sexual, fun, youthful, very G-rated costume play or cosplay. And then there's the R-rated suggestive. And then there's the full-on X-rated. But it's about dressing up as wild, fantastical characters and enjoying temporarily playing somebody else. And it's very developed, and the outfits are fantastic. So there's that.
Sounds like a heck of a lot of fun.
It is.
Now, does it have sexual overtones, or?
Well, as I just said, there's segments of it. As I just said, there's chunks of folks that, you know, they're kids, they're teenagers. It's very G-rated. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Then there's a section that's very R-rated of folks that enjoy a kind of a flirty, sensual level. And yes, there's also folks that enjoy it at a very X-rated level. And, you know, one single person who's into cosplay may enjoy it at all these different levels, depending on what context and who they're with.
Okay.
So let's say if you and I were cosplay, if you and I were lovers and we're both into cosplay, we might go to a Saturday afternoon costume role play festival with a lot of kids and hosted by the comic books and the animation company. It's all very G-rated, right? But then later on we might go to a grown-ups only cocktail party and the cosplay, and we're like flirting with, you know, other fun costume outfits. And then, you know, you and I might somebody else who's like, we both think is sexy in their costume, and then later on get on with some, you know, X-rated costume role play action. So,
yeah.
So it's very,
very, very hot.
It's very fun. It's very, yeah.
It seems like there's a lot more imagination and fun going on here than anything I could think of in America. Like, I don't know, like, you know, lifestyles parties and key parties.
You know, there's actually a cosplay culture in the United States.
Is there?
There is, and it borrows more from the Japanese cosplay style.
Very interesting. It's certainly not a term or a concept that I'm familiar with. But
yeah. And the costume and the role plays might borrow from specific animation character, or it could be a genre like goth Lolita. There are certain genres around it. There are designers that make entire careers out of the outfits.
Now, does this have any connection at all to things like, I'm thinking of furry people and pony people?
Sure, it can have overlap, absolutely. There are cosplay furries. And Japan as well as the U.S.
Okay.
So, yeah, you know, there's some really interesting cross-pollination going on. And these are the things that, sadly, for most Westerners traveling to Japan, it's going to be hard to get a foot in the door because many of the places are not accessible to foreigners.
And that's the thing. I had a boyfriend who did sex shows in Japan years and years and years ago, because he did it before I ever met him, and he was a little older than I. And I did get the sense that there was this huge underground in Japan that wasn't really legal, but it wasn't really heavily controlled either. And I'm just wondering, is that the way it is today, or has it changed?
It is very underground. Some things are less underground than others. But it is very underground, and it is very, it's mostly, the access to it initially would be through commercial venues. You know, places that put on shows, like where your boyfriend might have worked. Places that put on shows, but also commercially in the terms of, say, swingers clubs. You might have a membership to a swingers club, and that actually becomes, it's a very, people actually hang out at their membership swingers club as they would their local country club. So they'll be showing up and hanging out in the lounge and the restaurant and the bar in there, not necessarily to hook up and play, but, you know, that's where they hang out four nights a week.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes they might hook up with somebody and play and have sex. Sometimes they might just, you know, be there with their partner. But it becomes their social place.
Ah, very interesting. And is it that the porn is a little bit different too, isn't it? Or am I?
Oh my God, there's such a huge wide range of porn there. It's, and the trends come and go. But there's a huge range of porn, and both in terms of actual live actors as well as animated and cartoon, animated in terms of like moving images as well as comic books in book format. Lots and lots of material. And as I was saying earlier, I managed to make friends with the Lesbian Comic Artists Association. For this very reason, because I want to find out. Because I want to find out what it's about.
Well, we've got a sex celebrity comment on your show tonight. Annette Haven is checking in here, and she says, "I like Aspasia's answer. Hello Kitty was formidable. Laugh out loud. It could refer to cherry blossoms, too. They are famous for them." We just want to send a shout-out to Annette Haven. Apparently, she has been battling an illness, and she jokes. She's got a great sense of humor. She says she's had some problems with her wrist because of answering too much fan mail. It says she's still here. So good for you, Annette, and we're great. We're really glad to hear from you. So right now, Hello Kitty is
Hello Kitty is indeed extremely popular over there, and there are love motels with Hello Kitty theme rooms.
Are you kidding? Wow.
I'm not kidding at all. Not kidding whatsoever.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, so when you put on the Pink Japan show, is it video, slides, PowerPoint? Are you using props?
Well, let's see. There's a slideshow of the photos I've taken through my various travels. And there's a huge table of porn, ephemera, flyers for sex clubs, all these things that I pick up in my travels in Japan that would be impossible to get a hold of outside of Japan, because, you know, they just disappear. There are flyers for, say, a swingers club or a sex show or a lesbian dance club or the some book that I, gay male porn magazine I picked up, all these things that I pick up, and there's a huge table where people can come up and look at all of that.
Mm, wow. So you're kind of like your own traveling museum of sex.
A mini version of it, yes. So, kind of going behind the cherry blossom curtain.
Very nice. Now, are they still doing live sex shows in Japan, or is that something?
Oh, you can find it. Oh, yeah, you can totally find it. Yeah.
And here's a stereotype, a myth. Perhaps you can clear this up for us. But I had heard that it's forbidden to show female pubic hair in pornography.
Yes, there is a law about that, and you know, we owe that to Prince Albert and the occupying American forces.
Can you explain that?
I was hoping you'd ask. Okay, so the showing of the censorship, okay? Now, before the American occupation after World War II, there's this whole Meiji era in the National Reformation that happened when it went from feudal Japan into the modern Japanese era, okay? We're talking late 19th century. And during that time, Japan was very, very enamored with the superpower, global superpower at the time, which was the United Kingdom, Britain. And Victorian England, and their morality code in Victorian England was very much enforced and put into place by Prince Albert, the Prince Consort of Queen Victoria. Prince Albert, however, was German and a very sex-negative, sexually uptight German who, when he came over to Britain, now, pre-Victorian England was quite the swinging, wild, dirty, naughty, randy place. You know, when we think of British as being uptight, it's not necessarily historically true.
I guess that's just for people who haven't dated anybody from Britain.
there's a difference between the surface and underneath. I find that the British culture and the Czech culture have a lot of comfort and similarity with one another because they're both many layered cultures that are invested around appearance and class. So many layered. And so thanks to Prince Albert, there was like this whole Victorian morality code that was then imported into Japan right along with various other things like the subway planning and the national debate and the diet and the political system that was borrowed from Britain. They also borrowed heavily from Prussian Germany on the military structure as well. So you've got this Victorian by way of Germany morality structure that existed before World War II. Then there's World War II, Japan loses, you get the American forces occupying it and rewriting the Constitution. And as they're rewriting the Constitution, emperor is no longer a god, but they find, come across censorship codes that were carryovers from Victorian England. They're like, well, okay, we don't see a problem with this, and the censorship code, okay, arbitrary censorship code, if they can't see pubic hair, then they're not seeing anything, right? Because this was before, completely naked camel toe. Bush. So if they can't, the rationale was, if you can't see pubic hair, you also can't see the genitalia. So went the rationale. Because they possibly imagine shaving naked. It just wasn't part of the culture. Anyway.
Exactly.
So, it wasn't part of the culture in Britain, America, and Japan. Different in the Middle East, but that's a whole other story. And so the censorship went into place. Now, then in the 50s and 60s, and 1960s was the golden era of Japanese porn. And that censorship remained, and you had all these people manually pixelating film porno as well as blacking out printed 1960s. Now, as we get close to 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, the porn industry is trimming the pubic hair, also because of cultural norms and popularity, and the pixels are getting tinier and tinier because of increasing digital technology and cinema and porn technology, printing and video technology, right? And as we get into the 21st century, digital technology, the pixels are tiny, porn performers have very little pubic hair, so now you get situations where it's there's still a little bit of kind of homage to the pixelation. Now, you can also still get Japanese porn that was produced, or at least the editing and the finalizing done outside of Japan. Outside of Japan, but it might have been originally shot in Japan, but it was then finalized and, you know, made into the package and edited outside of Japan and then in pixelated.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that, I mean, it's just like here in America, we've always got these opposing forces. Like, you know, in 2003, it was Lawrence versus Texas at the Supreme Court deciding that, mm-hmm. you know, what two gay men do in the privacy of their own bedroom is nobody's business. And now I hear the Republican contingency in the state of Texas, you know, just these 7 years later, is trying to introduce legislation to make it illegal to have gay sex. Does Japan have those kinds?
Don't they have other problems to worry about, you know, like the economy?
Okay.
Oh, it just frustrates me. Okay.
Oh, well, yeah, world peace, the global warming, the Gulf
you know,
crisis.
Yeah, little things
two
like
wars.
That. Yeah.
But I'm just wondering if, since Japan is such a developed and advanced nation, if they also have those kind of factions, or if maybe it's a little more homogenous.
Okay. Political activism, politics in Japan is very different than here in the U.S. Until rather recently, there's been this father knows best kind of culture. The voting rate is really low. It is a democratic nation that does not understand the citizens aren't using their opportunity for the, you know, votes meaning something. They also have a very arcane election and campaigning law, which makes political involvement really tiresome for the ordinary citizen. Life goes on. Politicians are, kind of the attitude is, politicians know best. But at the same time, they also know that politicians are corrupt. But if they apologize, it's okay. And life goes on as usual. So the political forces and the things that change are, it feels glacial and slow when it comes to social changes in Japan. Because also the idea of individuals as being political activists, individual being a social agitator and social revolution in the sense that we've seen since 1968, or actually since we've seen since the civil rights movement, as well as go back further to the suffragist movement. Right, individuals and grassroots organizing as a way to change social injustice is not something that individual citizens have ingrained in them. Also, in terms of one's sexual identity and one's sexual activity as being something that pertains to civil rights and political activism is also very, very new. The sexual minority population, for example, the GLBTQI, gay, lesbian, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, queer, and intersex population, and their political activism is something, it's not even in its infancy, it's embryonic.
Oh, wow.
It's happening, but it's embryonic.
Okay.
It's not like in Russia where the parade is getting called illegal and then people are being arrested. It's just kind of a little parade that people just kind of look over and sort of ignore.
Oh.
Yeah. It's really a letdown. It's kind of like, oh. So, yeah, it's really at an embryonic stage because one's sexual activity and partner preference as being an identity. The identity politics of sexuality is a new thing that's being, the activism around that's really just starting. Because
that's fascinating.
Part of
over in this country, it's actually starting to end where people are just calling themselves fluid.
I don't think it's ending whatsoever. I mean, we're in California here with, fighting the whole Proposition 8. I don't think it's ending at all. And I would disagree with that. I think there are more people that are being comfortable perhaps with their bisexuality because statistically there really should be, more people that identify at some level as bisexual that's out. But I think there's been a fire put under the ass of civil rights around sexual minority lately.
Well, I certainly hope so. I know that people in my age group are very much, identified with that. I just go out to speak to the colleges and universities a lot, and sometimes I encounter a bit of an apathetic attitude about that. What I encounter a lot with college students is just there is an assumption because the entertainment that they have access to oftentimes expresses values that are more liberal than what the culture does. For instance, they can watch Diary of a Call Girl or Secret Diary of a Call Girl on Showtime. They can watch Hung, which is about a male escort on HBO. And I will often encounter young people who haven't actually left the universities yet, who are shocked to find out that prostitution's even illegal.
I don't know. The college age people that I've been meeting have been amazing activists. Amazing activists that I'm meeting. I'm meeting people that are forming political organizations, and I just met this fantastic trans guy who was doing work with educating the local law enforcement, and it started that in college. So I'm like all sorts of teary eyed with the kind of activism and awareness that I've been seeing in the college and high school age people that didn't exist when I was in high school and college.
Wow, that's encouraging. Great to hear that. What colleges are you thinking about, by the way?
Various places I've presented. Most recently, there was University of Colorado Boulder. I presented up in Humboldt. I presented over at UC Santa Cruz. So those were the ones most recently. And then, of course, I'm meeting college-age people in my various classes.
Right.
I don't know what all schools that they go to, but they're definitely in the 18 to 25 range.
Right. Of course, those are self-selected if they're coming to your workshop. But anyway, I'm certainly glad to know that we've got that youthful activists out there.
I think there's a heck of a lot more than there were, and there's always going to be an apathetic population. There's always going to be. But it's those who have the potential to be activists. Depending on the era, they're either dormant or they've been kicked into activism with a little fire under their butts. And I think right now the whole Proposition 8 thing, as well as the various, like what you just mentioned in Texas, I think it's waking people up saying, we can't just rely on, other people doing the right thing.
Because they won't, even in the state of California.
Yeah.
True enough. So, let's see. I was looking at your website here, and I was thinking you might want to tell us a little bit about your book. You've got some extraordinarily gorgeous book covers here. Wild Side of Sex. You've got a typewriter in your crotch. We've got Master Han's daughter. I think that's you, headed up a staircase or a ladder.
Yep, that is indeed me. I make a very accessible model. I usually say yes when I ask.
Yes. Well, look, now you've been in a lot of men's magazines, have you not, including Penthouse and Playboy?
I've written for Penthouse. And I've written a lot for Taboo. So it's my words and my brain have appeared in many of these. I've also written the sex advice column for Men's Health in the UK. Ages ago, I was in Playboy. That was neat. It was excuse me. That was actually quite the fluke because my boyfriend at the time submitted a photo of me, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'm going to get into Playboy. And I did. I was like, oh, my God. And no idea.
And then they said, we want you in here. Now, did you do a centerfold, or were you the girl next door, or what was that?
Oh, now it was years ago, something about the women of the Internet or something like that.
Okay.
So, no, not the centerfold, no.
I've seen your photos, and I'm sure you could have been. So it's all politics, as far as I'm concerned.
And, those books there, Seductive Art of Japanese Bondage, it's like in its fifth printing or something. It was the first English language book on the topic, and in many ways it introduced Japanese rope bondage to North America and English-speaking countries. So that book is near and dear to my heart. And Wildside Sex, that's the essay book, it's very much written from my heart around, the kinkier side of sex and why people do this, and without making it clinical, like a pathology, but also, some of the how-to books can be so dry. So this is more about the why it's hot.
Ah.
Master Han's Daughter is actually a collection of science fiction short stories all set in Japan, and that was when I got to really, some of the stories are actually erotic horror.
And
they're dark.
You wrote these. So you do multiple genres. So you're writing science fiction, and you're writing self-help. That's unusual. That's unusual for somebody to do different genres. Usually people stick with self-help, but I stick with fiction, but I don't do both.
I'm mostly on the nonfiction, but once in a while I've just got stories to tell that I got to get out.
Mm. And you've also got a company called Fire Horse Productions?
That's me and my all my various projects.
Okay.
Yeah, and I do weekend intensives as well, not just the small two-hour classes, which are great, but oftentimes they leave me frustrated because I have so much more that I want to teach. So I have a weekend intensive coming up called Forte Femme, which is a women's sensual dominance weekend intensive. I've got many gals that ask me, my boyfriend, my husband, my partner wants me to, erotically dominate them. Oh, my God, I don't know what to do. Or women who've been enjoying that, but it's like I've lost my fire, I've kind of lost the oomph behind it, and I have these short little classes, but that just wasn't enough, and I have so much to teach around finding a woman finding her authentic sensual power and her authentic voice. Now, we're not talking the cliched whips and chains. We're talking about a union exploration into one's place of fulfillment and power and a strong voice, and whatever she looks like in each woman to find that voice. And so it's a 2.5-day intensive where I do a brain dump with a small group, 10 women. And I also throw into it my Midori's private tour of the San Francisco sexual underground, and we take over one of the shops, and they give us a private, only
a
my
private dance.
Private shop. Yeah, we take over Stormy Leather.
Oh, nice!
And it's a 3-hour private shopping time.
Oh, wow!
It's great. It's absolutely fabulous having private shopping.
Is that part of Femme Forte or Rope Bondage Dojo?
No, that's part of the Forte Femme weekend.
Okay. All right. Forte Femme. What is Rope Bondage Dojo? Is that like self-defense?
No, it's 2 days of learning about Japanese-inspired rope bondage. But I run it much like a dojo in that there's a lot of drills. There's what I call my head, heart, and hands approach. There's learning about the psychology of it, learning about the soul and heart and how to connect with your partner more deeply, and also the rope techniques. Rope bondage seems to be all the rage right now, which I am delighted because it is beautiful, it is fun, it's pleasurable, and I've also got, you know, my cultural roots connection to it.
And how does Japanese bondage differ from bondage you find here in America?
Oh boy, that's an entire show. Yeah, every culture has its erotic style. Every culture has its erotic style. And if you take, for example, bondage, you might think of in the U.S., there will be handcuffs and the fuzzy handcuffs borrowed from the imagery of police. There might be also rope use that the images are borrowed from, say, the cowboy Western rope usage. So sexuality is also culturally influenced and determined as well. So images of that culture, yeah. And so in Japanese rope bondage, there's influences from historical stuff, theater stuff, and Japanese aesthetics, and this is a culture that can wrap anything. So it's not surprising that one wraps in an erotically compelling, fun, dirty way one's lover.
Huh.
Yeah. And so it's a whole particular style, but I teach a whole new way to look at that incorporates, you know, you got to be able to read your lover and give both you and yourself what you want. So you can't learn that from a book. Yeah, I wrote the book, but there's a time when you got to pick up the rope and you get to talk to the people and you get to practice over and over and you get the teacher. There's four of us cadre that work with a small group. Yeah, it's great. It's creative. It's high energy. It's connected. And it's beautiful. It's exhilarating. Yeah, it's fun.
That's one of the things that I always say. I go, you know, yeah, I'm a sexologist. Yeah, I'm, you know, a sex educator, and here's my certificates. But that's not the important thing. What you want to know is 14 years of hands-on experience with a wide variety of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, too, you know, when some people may have very adventuresome personal sex lives, but it's much, much different, I think, when, you know, you work with people in some professional capacity, whatever that may be, whether it's the sexological body work or in some form of kink or in my case as an escort, whatever that is, it is so important to be in that moment and in the breath and with the energy.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't make that translation just from the page.
It's
like trying to learn how to play tennis by reading a book.
Exactly. Exactly. And, so I'm doing these weekend intensives. And I'm also in the process of creating a lover's retreat because I teach a lot of lovely bedroom skills classes. And I'm going to be creating a weekend retreat where I'm teaching some of my hottest bedroom skills. And I teach them, and the couples get their own time to research and do their homework, and in a beautiful, peaceful place where, you know, if they want to just hold hands and sit on the porch, they can.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to go back in the...
Great. You could make it vacation packages, cruise packages.
Yep, and that's what it's going to be, and right now I'm working out the details on that, so... That'll probably be popping up on my calendar next year.
Well, we're going to have you back to tell us all about it so we can take the world tour with you.
Oh, my God. Okay. I would so, so love to, like, have you just come on by and visit, you know, drop in. That would be so cool.
So what else would you like our listeners to know before we sign off tonight? Would you like them maybe to know how to contact you or what city you're coming to next?
I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on LiveJournal, I'm on all that. But they can all find the links to all of that through planetmidori.com, including where I'm traveling to next.
Okay.
Yeah, and my upcoming trips include Toronto, Ottawa. I'm heading to New York as well.
New York.
And, yeah, New York City. And in and out of San Francisco, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then Copenhagen, heading to London. And that's just, and Chicago, L.A. And that's all just between now and the end of October.
Oh, my Lord. I thought that was maybe for all of 2010.
No, this was the next couple, 3 months.
Well, honey, I hope you're getting a lot of foot rubs in between all this stuff.
Yeah, not enough.
Foot rubs and massages. Thank you so much for enlightening us about Pink Japan. Very exciting stuff. And
oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and a little peek into Planet Midori. You really do have a world of your own, and I think people are just very blessed to be able to get to peek into that. And in a lot of ways, if people haven't seen you live, I haven't been to any of your workshops, you know, when you're talking about the costuming and just the theatrics that goes with that, you bring a lot of that to everything that you do. It's a high art form for you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for joining us in the Shame-Free Zone. We look forward to having you back here again. When
oh, my God, I totally want to come back. And good night. Peace and love to all.
Thank you. Good night, Midori. And for those of you who are still tuned in, I want to let you know what we're going to be doing next week. Next week, I am going to be interviewing Karina Renard. And she's going to be talking to us about somatic sexology and somatic psychology. So we'll be getting further into the body as well as into healing. And I'm going to be taking this show on the road. So for the next 2 weeks, I'm going to be on working vacation. I'm going to be going up into Oregon. I'll be hitting cities like Hillsboro, Portland, Eugene, Salem, and then I'll be coming back into Northern California, and I'll be up in Napa, Rohnert Park, speaking at Sonoma State University on the 29th. I'll be teaching a workshop, Things Your Doctor Doesn't Even Know About Sex. I'll be teaching that at Camouflage on August 3rd. And if you have not subscribed to my newsletter yet, then you need to do that. Go over to veronicamonet.com. You'll find a link to the newsletter there. You can go to sexwithoutshame.com. There's a link to the newsletter there. And you can also find it on Facebook. All you have to do there is go to the tab that says Join My List. And you can also, if you happen to not be my friend yet, God forbid, find the fan page. It's Veronica Monet's Shame-Free Zone. And right on the welcome page, you'll see a nice, pretty button. Takes you right over to subscription for the newsletter. The important thing is to get subscribed to it tonight because the newsletter is going to be going out tomorrow morning, and it'll have all my travel details in it. And here is the upshot. While I am in all these various different cities, I'm going to be making myself available for house calls. You heard me right. That means I can come meet you at your home or maybe some neutral place if you're feeling kind of shy or private. We can always meet at a coffee shop. Obviously, I can't offer you an office, but wherever you're comfortable, you can have an in-person session. And when I'm traveling, when I'm on tour, if I happen to be in your area and you book in advance, then the rate is the same as if you were having a telephone appointment, or if you came to see me at my office in Nevada City, California, which is in Northern California. So what you want to talk about during these sessions, I leave that mostly up to you. I'm here as a couples consultant, sexologist, and also just recently got certified as an anger management specialist. You may wonder what anger management has to do with your sexuality. It has everything to do with it. Somebody asked me this in the gym the other day, and this was my explanation. People come to me all the time, tell me they've been married or living together for years, used to have a really hot sex life. It's not hot anymore. It's gotten boring. It's gotten routine. Or it might have just completely evaporated and doesn't even exist anymore. And my question to any couple that's not having a passionate sex life that's getting better and better with each passing year is very simple. I just want to know what you're angry about. Fact of the matter is, most people will tell me they're not angry about anything, and the very next words out of their mouth will be, "We never fight." That's very sad. I know, people mean to brag about it. We never fight. That's nothing to brag about. What you need to do is learn constructive ways to be able to express your anger, because we all have them. There's a point in every relationship where you start to get frustrated with your partner. And if you're the kind of person who avoids conflict and doesn't want to be honest about those feelings, it's probably going to show up as boredom and a sense of that there's just something missing in the passion department. You just don't feel as fired up and hot as you used to. So that's anger. That's anger telling you that there's a problem. And no, it doesn't feel like anger. Because most of us, you know, we're ashamed to be angry. And I'm finding this more and more. People may have shame around their sexuality, but they've got even more shame around the emotions of anger. Anger is a beautiful, healthy, normal, natural emotion. The problem that we get into is in how we express it. And so that's something I teach people. I teach individuals and couples how to have anger in a healthy way so that you're not suppressing it and not tamping down and numbing out those orgasms, and also not destroying the relationship. That's why we choose not to get angry, or at least not to experience our anger, because we're afraid we're going to hurt the people we love. We're afraid we're going to destroy our relationships. We're afraid we're going to lose our job. There's all kinds of reasons we don't get angry. But you are angry. We're all angry. There's always a good reason to be angry, and there's some really constructive ways to learn how to express that, so that you will find you've got a better sex life than you ever thought possible. Anyway, many other things that I teach, of course. You know, Santa Cruz, I'm going to be talking about anatomy. I'm going to be exploring things like G-spots and prostate massage and male multiple orgasms and female ejaculation, and there's going to be a slideshow and videos, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So sign up for the newsletter, and you get all the details. And, of course, as always, you can contact me at veronica@sexwithoutshame.com. That's it for tonight. I will see you again Monday, 9 o'clock, next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian.